everyone, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for all of you today. My guest will be Randy Dresner. She is the President and Chief Executive Officer for Island Harvest. And Island Harvest is one of Long Island's largest hunger relief organizations. And we'll be talking more about the work she's doing and how they've been expanding and all the great stuff going on there. But before that happens, I want to talk about some things going on in the news, some ways you can take action, and of course, share my weekly recipe with all of you. So what's been going on right now is the NOFA New York's annual winter conference, which happens every year. This is our second year being virtual, which is certainly not as satisfying as meeting in person, because it was always something we farming community looked forward to as far as getting together and seeing everyone. I mean, New York State is such a big state that people are really scattered throughout the state. And so this was one time a year when we could all get together and see each other and meet each other and network. But now we're doing it virtually. And after 2 years, we're really learning how to do it. And we had a presentation from our Farmer of the Year this year, which was Zaid Curde. He is the farmer at Norwich Meadows Farms. And the work they're doing there and their story of how they started as a small 2-acre farm and grew to over 230 acres right now with 180 high tunnels is just amazing. And so listening to him talk, and also how he has collaborated with others and shared knowledge and worked together within the community, is just really wonderful. I think collaboration is really one of the keystones that I am getting out of my second year here with COVID, is that we just all need to collaborate more and work together and not be so competitive. I think sometimes the competition really gets in the way. And I know with all the grassroots organizations that are working to do great things, there's many overlaps. And I think there's times when we could really work together in a more cohesive way and really get more done. And so anyway, that's happening here at the NOFA Annual Winter Conference, where it's just a full schedule of sharing ideas and, you know, finding ways to share knowledge. And it's just really beautiful. One of the presenters that's going to be presenting on Sunday is Ian Tolhurst, who I have interviewed. And he is a vegetable grower in the UK, and he does all of his composting without using any animal products. And I thought that would be really interesting, because, you know, one of the discussions we have a lot in organic is the need for livestock. You know, it's been marketed now as regenerative agriculture, and, you know, using livestock to help build up the soil is really a wonderful way of using livestock in a healthy, organic way, as opposed to the CAFOs that just, you know, are factory farms. But he has actually worked on a way of building his soil and compost without using animal inputs. And I think, you know, that's always a discussion with people with diets, with the future of feeding the planet. You know, how much meat can we produce, how much meat is sustainable, is any meat sustainable? Anyway, it's a great conversation, and I'm really glad he's going to be a part of the NOFA conference this year as well. Some ways you can take action. We've all been hearing about voter suppression and gerrymandering, and I have a petition on my website that you can sign. That Friends of the Earth has put out to try to get some of the big oil companies out of politics. Right now, they pour millions of dollars into campaign contributions, and politicians are really supporting the big oil companies as opposed to supporting us. And we really need to get big oil out of our politics. And Friends of the Earth has this great petition for you all to sign. And it's really challenging sometimes in my work. I really want to focus on food and the environment. And there's so many topics that just overlap. You know, when you talk about food, it just goes into politics. It goes into economics. It goes into health. It goes, you know, it's one of the reasons I love the topic so much, but it really goes into so many different areas. It's an umbrella for bringing so many issues together. And so anyway, sign the petition if you can. Really appreciate that. And also, there's a call out to get in touch with your congressperson or representative to support banning fossil fuels. You know, this week in or last week in the governor's State of the State address, she talked about banning gas in all new construction. And that's great, but she's talking about doing it 5 years from now. And we really need to push that up and do it sooner. And Senator Kavanaugh and Assemblymember Gallagher have introduced legislation that would ban fossil fuels in new construction starting at the end of this year. So please sign that. And at the same time, as a chef who cooks on gas, the thought of having to cook on electric is really scary. Although I do have an induction wok, and you know, if you have electric and you're using induction cooking, it's much better than the old fashioned electric stove. So there is hope. And I want to share with all of you my recipe this week. I made a pumpkin and bean chili. You'll probably be seeing pumpkin in a lot of my recipes coming up because I grew so many Long Island cheese pumpkins this year and I need to use them before they go bad. So so this pumpkin bean chili is really great and I encourage you all to make it. So I started with 2 pounds of cooked beans, 2 pounds before they're cooked. They became much more than that after. It's equal to about 6 cans of beans. So if you don't want to cook your beans from scratch, I used a pressure cooker and I swear they cooked up in 10 minutes. I had soaked them, but they cooked so fast. I could not believe it. But anyway, you can use 6 cans of beans. You can use an assortment, black beans, kidney beans, pinto beans, whatever you like. 2 tablespoons of olive oil, 2 onions diced, 2 medium carrots diced, 2 jalapeno peppers diced, and that's optional. Obviously, if you don't like spicy, you can leave that out. I also put in 2 Thai peppers or any other hot peppers you have. Again, I'm working through all the hot peppers I grew this past summer. 2 tablespoons of minced garlic, 3 tablespoons of chili powder, 2 teaspoons of chipotle powder. Now, chipotle powder is similar to chili powder, except it has a smokier flavor to it and it's a little spicier. So, if you don't have chipotle powder, you can just add another tablespoon of the chili powder in there. 2 tablespoons of cumin powder, 1 14-ounce can of diced. I used regular diced tomatoes, and then I also had a can of fire roasted tomatoes that had chilies in it. Also, again, spicy. I get those at Trader Joe's, and they're great. They're organic. But if again, if you don't want this chili to be too spicy, just use regular diced tomatoes. 2 teaspoons of dried oregano, 2 tablespoons of tomato paste, 5 cups of cubed pumpkin. And I steamed the pumpkin first just so that the chili would come together quicker. So that was basically half of my pumpkin. Okay, so I used half of my Long Island cheese pumpkin, but again, there are so many different sizes, so I decided to measure it. It was about 5 cups of cubed pumpkin, maybe even closer to 6 because it was a heaping 5. 1.5 cups of fire roasted corn, and I buy that frozen fire roasted corn at Whole Foods and just keep that in the freezer, and I use that a lot, adding to my cornbread, adding to my stir fry rice. Anyway, it's great to have in the freezer. 1/2 cup of water, salt to taste, 1/2 cup of chopped cilantro. Again, if you're a cilantro hater, feel free to sub out parsley. 1 to 2 limes and 1 cup of cashews that I soak for an hour to make a cashew cream. And I have a recipe for that here as well. So in a large pot, you're going to heat the oil and then add the onions, carrots, and peppers. Cook that for a few minutes until the onions start to caramelize and the carrots are soft. Push the vegetables to the side and add some tomato paste into the center of the pot and let that cook for about 5 minutes, so that the flavor of the tomato paste really comes out. The tomato paste will darken a little, and that will add a lot of depth to the chili. Stir in the garlic, the chili powder, the cumin powder, the chipotle powder, and the oregano. Cook it a little bit more for another couple of minutes until the mixture starts sticking to the pan. Then add the cans of tomatoes and the salt to taste. Bring it to a simmer and let that cook a little bit more. Then you're going to add the steamed pumpkin and the beans to the pot and mix that up well. Add the water, mix it again, let it simmer, and then just let that cook down for about 30 minutes and all the flavors will come together. You want to be careful that the chili is not sticking to the bottom of the pan. And then you can taste it with just the spices. Add the cilantro before serving, and you can garnish it with the cashew cream. And to make the cashew cream, basically take that cup of soaked cashews, you're going to drain it, put it into a mini food processor or a blender, mix it with 3/4 cup of water and the juice of 1.5 limes and a pinch of salt, and just puree that until it's really smooth and it comes out kind of like sour cream. You want the thickness to be that of sour cream, so you can add some water if you need to. Taste it, add more lime or salt if you'd like, and that's it. It's really delicious, feeds a lot of people inexpensively. I serve it with rice, and that's it. And now it's my pleasure to introduce all of you to my guest today, Randy Shubin-Dresner. She's been with Island Harvest Food Bank since 2001, serving as president and chief executive officer for most of her tenure. Under her direction, Island Harvest has increased its income by more than 463%, and its distribution of meals helping people in need has increased by more than 196% in the past 13 years alone. During this time, the organization has expanded programming to include advocacy, food insecurity as the root causes, and they do an analysis and action around food insecurity, the creation of Workforce Skills Development Institute, holistic programming, and the acquisition of an organic farm. And we'll be talking more about the farm when she comes on. Randy was appointed by the New York State Governor to serve on the New York State Council on Hunger and Food Policy and the College Council at Farmingdale State College. She serves on many councils and boards, including the Suffolk County Food Policy Council, the Long Island Food Council, the Consultative Council of Nonprofit Leaders for Charity Navigator, and an Advisory Disaster Response Council for Feeding America. Randy is a frequent guest speaker at the national and local levels, contributing writer about issues related to human service needs, people first terminology, poverty, and more. She's a member of the Energia Partnership at Molloy College, which is a regional ethnical leadership academy. And recently, Randy has also been able to check off radio talk show host and podcast host from her bucket list with Conversations with Randy Shubin-Dresner. And we'll talk more about that. And it's my pleasure to introduce all of you to Randy. Hi, Randy.
Hey there. Sorry that that's so long. My goodness, I apologize.
I know. I didn't want to cut it out, though, because so much of it is so impressive, and it really gives everybody an idea of the full depth and work that you've been doing, which is just so, so impressive. So I thought maybe we could start actually with you just telling us a little bit about Island Harvest and when it started and its history before we get into what you're doing now.
Yeah, sure. Island Harvest is a food bank on Long Island. And this marks our 30th year, so we're really excited about that. We were started in 1992 by a woman who went into a local convenience store and saw that the managers were throwing food away at the end of the day. And she knew in Rockville Center there had to be people that needed food. So she asked the manager if he would consider donating the food, and he had some concerns, which were valid. How would the food get to the end user? And, what about liability? He was concerned about that. So she did a lot of research. She found that at the time, And it continues now. There are federal and state laws which protect people that donate and move food in good faith and practice food safety practices. So she went back to the manager and worked it out with him. And her first food run, as we call it, was going from that 7-Eleven in Rockville Center to a home for women and children who were victims of domestic abuse. And she brought those chicken salad sandwiches there. And as she was ready to leave, the women came running up after her and asked her, pleading with her, when will you be back? And she knew at that moment that this was going to be the beginning of something she would work on. And so that's how we started. We became a full-fledged nonprofit organization shortly after that. I'm with Island Harvest for, this will be my 21st year, and we've gone through lots of changes. So while we still do that work, we call that food rescue work, it's a program of Island Harvest. It's not the only thing that we do. And I guess as we're talking, we'll talk more about the full depth and breadth of the work we do at Island Harvest. But our mission is and continues to be to end hunger and reduce food waste here on Long Island.
And how has the food bank grown over the years?
Well, so normally, so, you know, up until COVID, we have grown to be an organization helping over 300,000 people each year. We have a network of about 400 community-based nonprofit organizations that partner with us. So prior to COVID, that was our one of almost our sole source of getting product out into the community. Mental health organization, a childcare organization, a rehabilitation organization, we'd give them the food. They would then distribute it out to people in need. And our food, by the way, prior to COVID, about 85% of our food came from donations from wholesalers, distributors, and supermarkets. And we started a farm about 5 years ago where we're growing organic, healthy foods and using it, one, obviously, to grow the food, to get it out into the community, but also to use it as a demonstration site. And again, I'm happy to talk about that as we continue. But COVID really changed everything. It changed it for everybody in this country. And for us at Island Harvest, it was a challenge that we met up with. And we literally lost our supply chain of all donated food the first week of March. At that same time, 90% of the agencies we work with in the community shut down because of COVID. And so we didn't have a way to get food in donated. We didn't have a way to get food out. We were also losing some of our volunteers because of the concerns about COVID. And so we completely changed our model. And in the end, we helped over 600,000 families through COVID, providing food, support, referrals, and services. We did mass food distributions. We did small food distributions. So we changed our model to depending on community-based organizations to help us get food out to a model where we did it almost 100%. And so we had some of the largest food distributions in New York State history. As an example, at the Nassau Coliseum, a couple of days before Thanksgiving in 2020, we met with 4,000 families in the parking lot with cars snaked around the Coliseum, down Hempstead Turnpike, and up the Meadowbrook Parkway. People waiting online for food from Island Harvest, doctors and lawyers and restaurant workers and hotel workers and others. And so we've changed, and we see now that we're not going back to the old style of Island Harvest. We've grown, and we're really excited about future ventures and future programs to keep us supporting the community.
So when you say you're not going back to the old model, does that mean the agencies that shut down, the small food pantries that are in the bottom, you know, basements of the churches and all that, they have not reopened? And
no, most of them have at this point. And so they're back in our network. We're still helping them and supporting them. But what won't change is that we're also doing a lot of our own direct work. Plus, interesting number, we're moving the same amount of food this year to date as we were in the heat of the pandemic. And so it means that we've also been working on capacity building for our network. We're working on helping to teach them how to take in more product and how to distribute more product to people in the community. And so because they're able to handle more now, and we're doing a lot of our own distribution, we're able to retain that level of distribution. So Bhavani, we are on target again to distribute over 15 million meals, or the equivalent of 15 million meals in this year alone. It's tremendous. The year before pandemic, we moved about 8 million meals. And so that's what we're looking to retain. Yeah.
That's a big growth. And you said most of your food comes from donations. And is that separate donations from individual corporations, or do they all give to one general food bank? Or I know, like in New York City, there's one main food bank that they all come to, and then the New York City food bank distributes it. Do you get it directly from a bigger food bank, or are you the food bank for Long Island?
So across the country, we have 200 sister food banks. So virtually every county in America is supported by one of the Feeding America food banks. Mm-hmm. Actuality, in New York City, there's City Harvest and the Food Bank for New York City. They're huge. Both of them are huge organizations serving millions of people a year. Here on Long Island, we are one of two food banks that support the community. We both do different things. We do some similar things. We're obviously collecting food or buying food and giving it out into the community. But it's what we do over and above that that really make us each unique organization. So we're still receiving, now we're back to receiving a lot of donated product, but we are also now in the business of buying food. And so we are spending millions of dollars each year now on purchasing food. And that gives us a lot of leverage. And Bhavani, I know that this is important to you and to your listeners. When we have dollars to spend on buying food, it means we could make the decision about what food to take in and distribute. And so we have the impact on good, healthy, nutritious foods. And we're guided by a team of dietitians on staff here at Island Harvest, which is somewhat relatively new. In food banking, it's new, but we feel it's very important to have the guidance of dietitians to help us. One, our purchasing people are meeting regularly with our dietitians to learn more about how to recognize foods that are healthy and foods that are not so healthy. We're also pairing foods together appropriately. We're pairing foods with recipes and with nutrition information. And we now have a very, very strong program we call Nutrition Path. It's a part of our program called Nutrition Pathways. We're working individually with people who have chronic health conditions, for example, diabetes or heart disease, taking medication and not quite understanding how what they eat impacts how the medicines work and how their body is. And we've also started these programs helping and supporting people with mental illness and people with substance abuse as well. Again, showing that there's a connection between what you eat and how you are physically and mentally.
Mm-hmm. So with nutrition in mind, do you refuse certain foods? Like, you know, there's so much junk food or candy or stuff with artificial preservatives that we know, especially after COVID, we saw how those that are on a bad diet were more heavily impacted by by getting very sick from COVID as opposed to those that were healthier. And being that you're serving the community that are mostly at risk, you have, as you said, you're now purchasing food, you have control of that. You're not only subjected to what leftovers people are giving you. So how has that changed?
Well, so look, I'll be honest. 20 years ago, 15 years ago, we were grateful to get a couple of pallets of Coca-Cola bread and bagels and pastries, because there was a theory back in those days, just fill the bellies was the expression that people in the community would use. So they would make contributions to us and they would say, you know, you're not refusing any kind of food, are you? And so that was then. And we've been on a progressive change, a tour to change our policies over the years. And so I could remember when I first started, there was one particular bagel owner in the town I live in who was donating 80,000 pounds of bagels a year. 80,000 pounds of bagels. It's insane. So our mission is to end hunger and reduce food waste. And so we worked with that bagel owner to teach him and to help him understand that you don't have to keep refilling the baskets at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. People will understand it if they're not completely full. And over time he learned that and he drastically cut back on what he was donating. And by the way, he saved money. And his customers appreciated it because not everybody wants a bagel and it's not healthy. We'd rather fill our trucks with healthy foods. So one of the items that are most requested seem to be produce, which is not a surprise, various meats and seafood and dairy products. People want to learn more about healthy eating. So our future is continuing to listen to what the community wants and needs, and not having us tell them what they want and need. And so we're spending time to make sure that our food and our services are culturally appropriate. We're not going to give dairy to every culture. Not everybody takes dairy. Also, we can't make assumptions. Just because we have it doesn't mean they're not getting it from another source. Maybe they need us to provide something different, blueberries. And so we're listening more. And then we're taking that information in. We're using it at meetings here, team meetings, so that we can better discuss it across all of our different verticals so that we can make good decisions across the entire organization.
Mm-hmm. One way that I've seen change also with COVID is prior to COVID, I know the food pantry that I worked with, the River Fund, you know, they had, you know, client's choice, I guess it was called, yes, where you could come in and kind of shop and pick what you wanted. So of course, those that, you know, prefer unhealthy food would just pick unhealthy food. But I think during COVID, it changed where people didn't want people coming in. So you were pre-boxing things. I don't know if you were, but I know this other food pantry and you're right. And Community Solidarity that I work with, they were pre-boxing. And so when you pre-box, you're giving people something, like you said, you were kind of providing full meals, you know, like putting a rice with a bean in the box, you know, and kind of thinking about how someone might use this. You know, if you're going to give pasta, you give a tomato sauce with it, you know, that kind of thing, if you're right, actually pre-boxing them. And I'm just curious, is that what you were doing as well, pre-boxing? Did you take requests or it was really...
Well, we couldn't take requests because we were literally feeding 600,000 people. Right. But what we did was really turn to our dietitians to help guide us with what we were putting in the boxes. So most of the boxes were put together with pre-purchased food. And so they were helping us put the food plans together. And to your point, Bhavani, we wanted to make sure that we were putting as many whole meals together as possible. And so where we could, if we were putting pasta in, we put the sauce in if we were able to have it. There were some times during the pandemic where some of the product was on short supply. There was one time that we couldn't get pasta sauce in any way, shape, or form. And we were looking at how to be creative over it. But as much as we could, when we were distributing food boxes, which was a large part of what we were doing, we were trying to make them as healthy as possible. We were using our dietitians to guide us with that. And when possible, we were pairing it with other product like produce, because we didn't want to put the produce prepackaged that. That was coming on a daily basis and getting that out into the community. And so, you know, guided purchasing is important. Teaching everyone about healthy eating is important. So our teaching can't be just to the outside. It has to be inside too. Our staff needs to learn about it, you know, because we're out there with our community empowerment programs, working one-on-one with individuals and families and guiding them with referrals and resources. So we need to all be talking the same message. So it's consistency that we found is really important. And we've gotten some really good feedback. Look, we can't force every food pantry out there to only provide healthy food. They don't have the resources in some cases. When you depend on food being donated from food drives, food collections, people with the greatest intentions in the world go into a supermarket with the plan to donate to the organization on the other side of that door. And when they walk through the store, they're thinking, oh my goodness, you know, if my child, we were struggling and couldn't put food on the table, oh, let me get them some cookies. They should have a cookie. And so, yeah, we are still getting some of that product, and it's well-meaning people. That's okay. We're going to distribute that. We get it in. We're going to distribute it. We're not in a place right now where we're dictating how people should be eating. You know, we want to respect people's wishes. I learned long ago from a very, very, very important colleague of mine in a similar business, it's not up to us to dictate what's happening. We don't know what's happening in somebody else's life. And if that happens to be the only vice they have, then so be it, if that's what's going to get them through the day. And so we work real hard to provide the healthiest food we could provide, but to support the pantries in the community as well. And so if they have foods that are not so healthy, if we could help support them with the healthy foods, then it gives them a little bit of a balance. Mm-hmm. It's a long answer. I apologize.
That's okay. Well, you know, I know of being on the side where people are asking for, you know, the community to make donations. It all has to be shelf stable also, because there's no refrigeration, you know, in the synagogues or the churches where people are dropping off cans and things like that. But now that you're purchasing food and I hear that you're purchasing more fresh fruits and vegetables, how do you deal with refrigeration? I mean, I think a lot of these pantries don't have access to refrigeration, or refrigeration seems to be a lot of the problem when you're talking about meats or dairy or fresh produce.
So that's a really fair question. I appreciate the question. And I have a couple of things on that side of it. So number one, from Island Harvest perspective, we have a lot of refrigeration and freezer space. In some cases, it's outside the organization. We just bought a building. We're in the process right now of building a 4,600 square foot refrigeration and freezer system.
Wow.
We have tractor trailers that go down to freezing if we need it. So obviously we can handle it. All of our trucks upon delivery are all refrigerated or can go down to freezing. We're in the process of creating a capacity building program where we will be giving grants out to the agencies within our network that need funding to give them better capacity. And so, Bhavani, if that means they need a refrigerator, they're going to write a grant and ask for the refrigerator. And if it's well written with a good plan, then we will give them the grant to buy that refrigerator or the freezer or the shelving, whatever they need. A lot of times what we've created is something that we call just-in-time delivery. So if we know that Agency X is delivering on Wednesdays at 10 o'clock, then sometimes we could plan a delivery on Wednesdays at 8 o'clock, and we could drop the load there. They could get it ready so that at 10 o'clock they could distribute it. And so it could be produce, it could be dairy, it could be meat, because it's within the cold chain period of time and the process. Uh-huh. We've also given out on capacity building, we gave grants of freezer blankets to our network so that when they're picking up food and transporting it or storing it at a distribution site, they could use the freezer blanks to retain the temperature as best as possible in order to respect that cold chain. So we're doing a lot of work in that area so that we could make sure that they have the capacity to take perishable product and that we are giving them enough to support the needs in the community.
Wonderful, wonderful. Now you also, you mentioned that you're doing an empowerment program, like a one-on-one empowerment. What is that?
We call, years ago, we had a very tiny team of people who were doing a lot of SNAP, which is food stamp outreach. And we were helping educate people in the community about SNAP. And then we were helping them enroll in SNAP. And then when they had issues with it, we would mediate for them. And so it was a very successful program, but we realized that there's so much more that people need. You know, if you're a family struggling to put food on the table, there's a high probability you have a lot of other issues that you need to deal with your family. And so our team started to grow the work and the support we were giving directly one-on-one with people. More recently, in the past 2 years, we renamed the division, calling it our Community Empowerment Program Division. And this is a team of people. Some are volunteers. And by the way, we're always looking for volunteers who have an interest in nutrition and health and social services. So it's a team of volunteers and staff that are out in the community all the time. At specific programs and libraries and laundromats. But we also do a sort of telehealth model where we help people over the phone as well. And that's what community empowerment is, empowering the community to get closer to stability.
Oh, that's wonderful. You know, I think that's the key to really a successful program, because as you said, it's not just food that these families are struggling with.
Vani, we're not going to end hunger by just giving somebody a can of food. You and I know that. And so that's the direction that we're taking. We'll continue to give that can of food to people, or hopefully that head of good broccoli or whatever it may be. But we need to do more than that to help people.
Mm-hmm. And so now that you are actually in the market of purchasing food, where do you get most of your produce from? Are you getting it from individual farms? I actually want to talk about your farm too. You said you now have a farm. Is that at Sisters of St. Joseph? Is that the farm?
Yes, we have a couple of acres on that campus, and we have a farmer that works year-round with us and all the farm equipment. So this year coming up, we're really excited about. We put a lot of plans in place, so it's going to be terrific. We're growing dozens and dozens and dozens of variety of crops. All healthy crops, and we have corporate people and volunteers help us out to tend to the farm.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really been a wonderful experience. So that's one part of where we're getting some of our food. It's a small amount compared to
what you need is
the rest of the organization, but we get our food from our farmers here on Long Island. Even though our farms typically on Long Island cost a little bit more, we feel strongly about supporting the Long Island Farm Bureau. We have a really wonderful relationship. And we buy food from New York State farmers and producers and then elsewhere. We're also connected to other food banks. So sometimes we sort of trade food with each other. If we have an excess, we had an excess of 300,000 apples a couple of months ago. And so we shared it with our colleague food banks across New York State. And so our food comes, and we get produce from supermarkets and wholesalers as well.
Mm-hmm. So can we talk about the kitchen? Because
yeah,
a place that, you know, really I'm excited about to hear that you're building a kitchen. Can you tell my listeners about that and what your plan is for the kitchen?
I'm excited about this. So we moved into a new facility literally a year ago, and we're in Melville. And we had a capital campaign, and we had visions of creating a nutrition demonstration center plus a workforce institute. And this building is allowing us to do that. And so we're looking for grants to help support this, but we're going to be creating a as close to a state-of-the-art demonstration kitchen as we can. And we will be bringing groups and individuals in to teach and guide them about healthy eating and cooking and understanding more about nutrition education and using this as a center point to do all of that. So we're really excited about it. The other part of it is it allows us to expand the nutrition outreach that we do and pair it up with different programs that we have within the organization. So community empowerment can then refer more people to our Nutrition Pathways program, for example. We're going to be rolling out a Workforce Development Institute in a couple of months, where we'll be training people on very specialized technical and non-technical skills in warehousing and repacking food, computer skills training, a number of different things. But we're going to use the resources in our Nutrition Demonstration Center as well, so that all of the students coming through who may be unemployed or underemployed will have the opportunity to meet with our professionals and learn more about that intersection of eating healthy and being healthy.
So the workforce development program that you're establishing is reaching out into your community and trying to retrain people that are without a job right now?
In some cases, look, we have the resources, the connections with all sorts of people across Long Island. When you think that we helped anywhere between 400 and 600,000 families. And so we'll be reaching out to or opening up the program to people who are, some of them will be working, but they want to improve their skills so that they could upskill themselves and right. perhaps get more income. People who are unemployed. And we'll be giving them all sorts of skills and trainings, technical and non-technical. We're also looking at youth at risk, to involve them in this program before they graduate high school, before they get into the pipeline of, not every student is college bound. And we need to respect that and honor that and then teach them the skills so that they could become professionals in other occupations. Mm-hmm. And so all of those are going to be part of our target audience for our institute.
Oh, that's really exciting. Good. Well, I really look forward to seeing how that grows and maybe being a part of it, especially the kitchen part, obviously, because
you've been connected to Island Harvest for a long time, Bhavani. And what I love about this conversation is you're somebody that has known us from back in the day, as I like to say, and I'm very proud for all of us of the growth of Island Harvest. And it's not just because of it's not benefiting us at Island Harvest, it's benefiting the community, and that's what we're most proud of.
Mm-hmm. And I love also that you're addressing not just the food, but really addressing this, the root cause, poverty, right? And we need to really lift people up and lift families up. And, you know, when you talk about the youth, you know, like I mentioned, the River Fund, the food pantry I work with, I don't know if you know them, but I'm very close to them. They have a whole program, they call it Cradle to College.
Right.
You know, and they really try to help the families from when the kids are born and, you know, they watch them grow. I mean, you know, 20 years, we've been at this 20 years. I'm sure you've seen families where, you know, the mother had a baby and now the baby's like on, you know, getting boxes as well. And, you know, and how we can break that cycle of poverty so that the kids actually, if they don't go to college, at least get the training, as you were saying, so that they really can make a decent living and get out of poverty, because that's really the root cause here.
One of them.
Yeah. Do you have any special programs for young mothers? Young mothers, babies, anything like that?
Yeah, we that would be through our community empowerment program, finding the right connections for some of those young moms to find the resources that they need. Also, we were fortunate, our friends at New York State created a connection to create sort of like a diaper bank in the state. And so ongoing, we're receiving diapers that we could get out into the community, which is a very, very difficult thing for some people. I mean, clearly you need diapers. They're expensive. So the more we could get to distribute out to the community, the better. We get donations of formula and baby food often, and try to work in educating moms about the dates that are on baby food, how important that is, and not to water down formula or milk that they give to children and babies. So that's part of the education programs that we have as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I was just wondering also whether there was any targeted nutrition programs, because, you know, when I hear the stats on mortality rates for mothers of color and their babies compared to white folks, it's just, you know, it's horrible. Yeah. And we have some of the worst mortality of any Western developed country. Yeah. So, you know, just whether there's any targeted programs to try to get good nutrition into pregnant moms and well health care and stuff like that.
We're as disturbed as you are by those statistics and really looking at what kind of programs we could develop to help and support them. We're also looking at very strategic partnerships. We've got a very special relationship with the largest health system in New York State, Northwell. And we are running a number of programs with them as well. So, you know, look, we're not at the point where we could say we're done. We're ever growing and looking at what new programs we could create to best support people in the community by listening to what they're telling us they need.
Mm-hmm. So where do you see yourself going now in the next 5 years? What things besides the kitchen? I guess you meant so many, the kitchen and the workforce. What other programs are you developing that you...
So what I've learned from COVID is I don't do long-term planning because you could have a pandemic. And who would have ever expected that we would have ever seen a pandemic? I thought that was a fake word from sci-fi. So, you know, we do our long-range planning right now is we got 1 to 3 years. And knowing that that's an ever evolving, we're concentrating on our nutrition programs right now and on our workforce development, and doing more listening and root cause, analysis and action work. So those are the three areas that we're really spending the most time on. And I see that happening for the next year or two.
Mm-hmm. And so if my listeners want to volunteer, how do they go about getting in touch with Island Harvest?
We encourage people to get involved in a couple of different ways. And so, Bhavani, if your listeners want to go to islandharvest.org, O-R-G, you could find ways to contribute funds, to donate food, and to volunteer your services. And in the coming months, you'll find more information on advocacy as well and how you could create action.
Mm-hmm. And what parts of your job do you find the most rewarding? I mean, I can imagine that so much of your work is, but you personally, what part of your work are you most excited about?
You know, I was just in a meeting this morning with our development team, and one of them said she loves at the end of the day to drive toward our back parking lot before she goes out the front driveway, because she loves looking at the trucks, because the trucks have a lot of meaning. I smiled because I actually do that twice a day. I do it in the morning when I come into work. I'm here very early and I drive in the back and look at our trucks, because and then at the end of the day when I'm leaving. And because to me, it's significant. It shows me the work we're doing and the impact we have in the community. Each of those trucks, the regular trucks, hold over 7,000 pounds of food. Our tractor trailers hold, five times that. Each pound represents a meal and a half. And so it means that we're really helping people. I know the shift that we've made to just taking anything to now being more selective has made a very big impact on the health and well-being of a lot of the people that we're helping across the community. And so for me, that's the guiding post for the work that we do. I just got a letter in the mail last week, a contribution of $75. And with it came a note. And the note said this: "This gift is made in honor of Island Harvest, because when I didn't have food, you fed me. Thank you."
Oh,
that's what it's all about.
That's great. That's great. And what else did I want to ask you?
So I could tell you a little bit about our volunteer corps. I know we only have a couple of minutes, but let me tell you, we have, prior to COVID, we had about 14,000 people registered as volunteers with Island Harvest. And while not all of them were volunteering at the same time, or some of them were volunteering for an event here, and not consistently, when COVID first hit, most of our volunteers told us that they couldn't come out to volunteer because they were concerned, and we understood and respected that. But over that year and a half, we took in 3,000 new volunteers who had said to themselves, they shared this with us, "If ever I had the time to give back in the community, I want to be sure to do that." And they sat at their homes and said, "This is the time." We made sure we were following all the appropriate COVID protocols, and we still do. And so we had volunteers out in the community helping us to pack boxes in the community, distribute food, direct traffic, take information from people that needed to give it to us. They helped us pack boxes in warehouses, and a lot of other tasks. Some of COVID has changed a lot, and so we've broadened how volunteers work with us and help us. And so we have regular teams that are here at our warehouse sorting and packing food that come in. You know, when we get a truckload from a supermarket, it's called salvage, but it's mixed and assorted food. And so we are going to be getting a team back up to help us go through all that product and sort it into different bins so we can more easily get it out into the community. Mm-hmm. Volunteers help guide us. If you have an expertise in marketing, in sales, in nutrition, in social services, whatever it may be, we could pair that skill with a program that we're providing here. We have various task forces, which helps us to do that. And so it's all about how the volunteer wants to help us. It's, again, listening. So we're not going to put somebody in a role they don't want to be in. But we very much appreciate all of the support we get from volunteers. And by the way, we have a lot of corporate teams coming through. And yeah. So many of them make a contribution to do this, but they come in on a scheduled basis. They spend a couple of hours here in the warehouse or in the offices or actually in the farm and help us to tend to the farm during the better weather days. Uh-huh. So we find lots of good ways for people to become involved with Island Harvest.
Yeah. And I was at Island Harvest in your other location, Hopog, right?
Yes.
How did you manage to move during the COVID? Did you give up the other place and you're all under one roof now in Melville?
So how crazy is it to buy a building and move in the middle of a pandemic when we're a first responder? I don't know. But we found the building. Uh-huh. We couldn't pass up this building. And so we did do that. And we consolidated a couple of our facilities. We've had five facilities at one time. So we consolidated. Now we are still running three facilities. So we have a warehouse in Uniondale. We have the main facility in Melville. And then we have a facility out in Calverton, which is like Riverhead on the east end. This way it allows us to really service and support the whole island. So Hopog is still with us, but we're going to be closing that operation down in the coming months.
Uh-huh. Well, it's amazing. Randy, thank you. Thank you for the work you're doing out there.
I represent a team of people. It is not me, but a huge team of very dedicated people. But thank you for that.
Yeah. You know, I was really happy to be able to act as an intermediary person during Thanksgiving, get turkeys from one place that I wasn't using because I wasn't doing my Thanksgiving this year, and passing them on to Island Harvest. And it gave me a lot of pleasure to see you there in the parking lot with all your volunteers. So thanks again. Everyone who's been listening and joining us today, thank you so much for joining us. Please consider making a donation to Island Harvest, getting in touch with them if you want to volunteer. And if that's not your thing, finding somewhere that is your thing, because we all need to do something to help make our world a better place. So thank you, Randy, for the work you do. And everybody out there, have a great rest of the week, and I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.